Chapter 3. But if we had, John, think what sorrow would be in our hearts this night, with our little feeling run away, and stolen in the city nowheres at all. Ye talk foolishness, said Mr. McCaskey. Tis Paddy would be named, after me old father in Cantrum. Ye lie, said Mrs. McCaskey, without anger. Ye brother was worth 10 dozen bog-trotting McCaskies. After him would the by be named. She leaned over the window sill, and looked down at the hurrying and bustle below. John, said Mrs. McCaskey, softly, I'm sorry I was hasty with ye. 'Twas hasty puttin', as ye say, said her husband, and hurry up turnips, and get a move on ye coffee. 'Twas what ye could call a quick lunch, all right, and tell no lie. Mrs. McCaskey slipped her arm inside her husband's, and took his rough hand in hers. Listen at the crying of poor Mrs. Murphy, she said. 'Tis an awful thing for a bit of a bye, to be lost in this great big city. If 'twas our little feelin', John, I'd be breaking me heart. Awkwardly Mr. McCaskey withdrew his hand. But he laid it around the nearing shoulders of his wife. 'Tis foolishness, of course, said he, roughly, but I'd be cut up some myself if our little Pat was kidnapped or anything. But there never was any childer for us. Sometimes I've been ugly and hard with ye, Judy. Forget it. They leaned together, and looked down at the heart drama being acted below. Long they sat thus. People surged along the sidewalk, crowding, questioning, filling the air with rumors, and inconsequent surmises. Mrs. Murphy plowed back and forth in their midst, like a soft mountain down which plunged an audible cataract of tears. Couriers came and went. Loud voices and a renewed uproar were raised in front of the boarding house. What's up now, Judy? Asked Mr. McCaskey. 'Tis Mrs. Murphy's voice, said Mrs. McCaskey, harking. He says she's after finding little Mike asleep behind the roll of old linoleum under the bed in her room. Mr. McCaskey laughed loudly. That's yer feelin', he shouted, sardonically. I'll a bit would a Pat have done that trick. If the bye we never had, is strayed and stole, by the powers, call him feelin', and see him hide out under the bed like a mangy pup. Mrs. McCaskey arose heavily, and went toward the dish closet, with the corners of her mouth drawn down. Policeman Cleary came back around the corner as the crowd dispersed. Surprised, he upturned an ear toward the McCaskey apartment, where the crash of irons and chinaware, and the ring of hurled kitchen utensils seemed as loud as before. Policeman Cleary took out his timepiece. By the deported snakes, he exclaimed, John McCaskey and his lady have been fighting for an hour and a quarter by the watch. The missus could give him 40 pounds weight. Strength to his arm. Policeman Cleary strolled back around the corner. Old man Denny folded his paper and hurried up the steps just as Mrs. Murphy was about to lock the door for the night. The skylight room, first Mrs. Parker would show you the double parlors. You would not dare to interrupt her description of their advantages and of the merits of the gentleman who had occupied them for 8 years. Then you would manage to stammer forth the confession that you were neither a doctor nor a dentist. Mrs. Parker's manner of receiving the admission was such that you could never afterward entertain the same feeling toward your parents, who had neglected to train you up in one of the professions that fitted Mrs. Parker's parlors. Next you ascended one flight of stairs and looked at the second floor back at $8. Convinced by her second floor manner that it was worth the $12 that Mr. Tusenberry always paid for it until he left to take charge of his brother's orange plantation in Florida near Palm Beach, where Mrs. McIntyre always spent the winters, that at the double front room with private bath, you managed to babble that you wanted something still cheaper. If you survived Mrs. Parker's scorn, you were taken to look at Mr. Skidder's large hall room on the third floor. Mr. Skidder's room was not vacant. He wrote plays and smoked cigarettes in it all day long. But every room hunter was made to visit his room to admire the lambrequins. After each visit, Mr. Skidder, from the fright caused by possible eviction, would pay something on his rent. Then if you still stood on one foot, with your hot hand clutching the three moist dollars in your pocket, and hoarsely proclaimed your hideous and culpable poverty, nevermore would Mrs. Parker be Cicerone of yours. She would honk loudly the word Clara, she would show you her back, and march downstairs. Then Clara, the colored maid, would escort you up the carpeted ladder that served for the fourth flight, and show you the skylight room. It occupied 7x8 feet of floor space at the middle of the hall. On each side of it was a dark lumber closet or storeroom. In it was an iron cot, a washstand and a chair. A shelf was the dresser. Its four bare walls seemed to close in upon you like the sides of a coffin. Your hand crept to your throat, you gasped, you looked up, as from a well, and breathed once more. Through the glass of the little skylight you saw a square of blue infinity. $2, sir, Clara would say in her half-contemptuous, half-Tuskegenial tones. One day Miss Leeson came hunting for a room. She carried a typewriter made to be lugged around by a much larger lady. She was a very little girl, with eyes and hair, that had kept on growing after as he had stopped, and that always looked as if they were saying, "Goodness me! Why didn't you keep up with us?" Mrs. Parker showed her the double parlors. "And this closet," she said, "one could keep a skeleton or anesthetic or coal, but I am neither a doctor nor a dentist," said Miss Leeson, with a shiver. Mrs. Parker gave her the incredulous, pitying, sneering, icy stare that she kept for those who failed to qualify as doctors or dentists, and led the way to the second floor back. $8? Said Miss Leeson. "Hear me. I'm not Eddie, if I do look green. I'm just a poor little working girl. Show me something higher and lower." Mr. Skidder jumped, and strewed the floor with cigarette stubs at the rap on his door. "Excuse me, Mr. Skidder," said Mrs. Parker, with her demon smile at his pale looks. "Didn't know you were in. I asked the lady to have a look at your lambrequins." "They're too lovely for anything," said Miss Leeson, smiling in exactly the way the angels do. After they had gone, Mr. Skidder got very busy erasing the tall, black-haired heroine from his latest unproduced play and inserting a small, roguish one with heavy bright hair and vivacious features. "Anna Held'll jump at it," said Mr. Skidder to himself, putting his feet up against the lambrequins and disappearing in a cloud of smoke like an aerial cuttlefish. Presently the tocsin call of Lara sounded to the world the state of Miss Leeson's purse. A dark goblin seized her, mounted a Stygian stairway, thrust her into a vault with a glimmer of light in its top, and muttered the menacing and cabalistic words, $2. "I'll take it," sighed Miss Leeson, sinking down upon the squeaky iron bed. Every day Miss Leeson went out to work. At night she brought home papers with handwriting on them, and made copies with her typewriter. Sometimes S.E. had no work at night, and then she would sit on the steps of the high stoop with the other roomers. Miss Leeson was not intended for a skylight room when the plans were drawn for her creation. She was gay-hearted and full of tender, whimsical fancies. Once she let Mr. Skidder read to her three acts of his great unpublished comedy, It's No Kid, or The Air of the Subway. There was rejoicing among the gentlemen roomers whenever Miss Leeson had time to sit on the steps for an hour or two. But Miss Longnecker, the tall blonde who taught in a public school and said, "Well, really, to everything you said," sat on the top step and sniffed. And Miss Dorn, who shot at the moving ducks at Coney every Sunday, and worked in a department store, sat on the bottom step and sniffed. Miss Leeson sat on the middle step, and the men would quickly group around her. Especially Mr. Skidder, who had cast her in his mind for the star part in a private, romantic, unspoken drama in real life. And especially Mr. Hoover, who was 45, fat, flush and foolish. And especially very young Mr. Evans, who set up a hollow cough to induce her to ask him to leave off cigarettes. The men voted her the funniest and jolliest ever, but the sniffs on the top step and the lower step were implacable. I pray you let the drama halt, while Chorus stalks to the footlights, and drops an obsidian tear upon the fatness of Mr. Hoover. Tune the pipes to the tragedy of tallow, the bane of bulk, the calamity of corpulence. Tried out, Falstaff might have rendered more romance to the ton, than would have Romeo's rickety ribs to the ounce. A lover may sigh, but he must not puff. To the train of Momus are the fat men remanded. In vain beats the faithfulest heart above a 52-inch belt. Avant, Hoover. Hoover, 45, flush and foolish, might carry off Helen herself. Hoover, 45, flush, foolish and fat as meat for perdition. There was never a chance for you, Hoover. As Mrs. Parker's rumor sat thus one summer's evening, Miss Leeson looked up into the firmament, and cried with her little gay laugh. Why, there's Billy Jackson. I can see him from down here too. All looked up some at the windows of skyscrapers, some casting about for an airship, Jackson guided. It's that star, explained Miss Leeson, pointing with a tiny finger. Not the big one, that twinkles the steady blue one near it. I can see it every night through my skylight. I named it Billy Jackson. Well, really, said Miss Longnecker. Didn't know you were an astronomer, Miss Leeson. Oh, yes, said the small stargazer, I know as much as any of them about the style of sleeves they're going to wear next fall in Mars. Well, really, said Miss Longnecker. The star you refer to is Gamma, of the constellation Cassiopeia. It is nearly of the second magnitude, and its meridian passage is O, said the very young Mr. Evans. I think Billy Jackson is a much better name for it. Same here, said Mr. Hoover, loudly breathing defiance to Miss Longnecker. Think Miss Leeson has just as much right to name stars as any of those old astrologers had. Well, really, said Miss Longnecker. I wonder whether it's a shooting star, remarked Miss Dorn. Hit 9 ducks and a rabbit out of 10 in the gallery at Coney Sunday. He doesn't show up very well from down here, said Miss Leeson. You ought to see him from my room. You know you can see stars even in the daytime from the bottom of a well. At night my room is like the shaft of a coal mine, and it makes Billy Jackson look like a big diamond pin that Night fastens her kimono with. There came a time after that, when Miss Leeson brought no formidable papers home to copy. And when she went out in the morning, instead of working, she went from office to office, and let her heart melt away in the drip of cold refusals transmitted through insolent office boys. This went on. There came an evening, when she wearily climbed Mrs. Parker's stoop at the hour, when she always returned from her dinner at the restaurant. But as he had had no dinner. As she stepped into the hall, Mr. Hoover met her, and seized his chance. He asked her to marry him, and his fatness hovered above her like an avalanche. She dodged, and caught the balustrade. He tried for her hand, and she raised it, and smote him weakly in the face. Step by step she went up, dragging herself by the railing. She passed Mr. Skidder's door as he was red-inking a stage direction for Myrtle Dellerm, Miss Leeson, in his unaccepted comedy, to pirouette across stage from L to the side of the Count. Up the carpeted ladder she crawled at last, and opened the door of the skylight room. She was too weak to light the lamp or to undress. She fell upon the iron cot, her fragile body scarcely hollowing the worn springs. And in that earbus of the skylight room, she slowly raised her heavy eyelids, and smiled. For Billy Jackson was shining down on her, calm and bright, and constant through the skylight. There was no world about her. She was sunk in a pit of blackness, with but that small square of pallid light framing the star, that as he had so whimsically and oh, so ineffectually named. Miss Longnecker must be right. It was Gamma, of the constellation Cassiopeia, and not Billy Jackson. And yet she could not let it be Gamma. As she lay on her back she tried twice to raise her arm. The third time she got two thin fingers to her lips, and blew a kiss out of the black pit to Billy Jackson. Her arm fell back limply. Goodbye, Billy, she murmured faintly. You're millions of miles away, and you won't even twinkle once. But you kept where I could see you most of the time up there, when there wasn't anything else but darkness to look at, didn't you? Millions of miles. Goodbye, Billy Jackson. Clara, the colored maid, found the door locked at 10 the next day, and they forced it open. Vinegar, and the slapping of wrists and burnt feathers proving of no avail, someone ran to phone for an ambulance. In due time it backed up to the door with much gong clanging, and the capable young medico, in his white linen coat, ready, active, confident, with his smooth face half debonair, half grim, danced up the steps. Ambulance call to 49, he said briefly. That's the trouble? Oh, yes, doctor, sniffed Mrs. Parker, as though her trouble, that there should be trouble in the house, was the greater. Can't think what can be the matter with her. Nothing we could do would bring her to. It's a young woman, a Miss Elsie, yes, a Miss Elsie Leeson. Never before in my house, what room? Cried the doctor in a terrible voice, to which Mrs. Parker was a stranger. The skylight room. It evidently the ambulance doctor was familiar with the location of skylight rooms. He was gone up the stairs, four at a time. Mrs. Parker followed slowly, as her dignity demanded. On the first landing she met him coming back bearing the astronomer in his arms. He stopped and let loose the practiced scalpel of his tongue, not loudly. Gradually Mrs. Parker crumpled as a stiff garment that slips down from a nail. Ever afterward there remained crumples in her mind and body. Sometimes her curious rumors would ask her what the doctor said to her. Let that be, she would answer. If I can get forgiveness for having heard it, I will be satisfied. The ambulance physician strode with his burden through the pack of hounds that follow the curiosity chase, and even they fell back along the sidewalk abashed, for his face was that of one who bears his own dead. They noticed that he did not lay down upon the bed prepared for it in the ambulance the form that he carried, and all that he said was, "Drive like H.L. Wilson, to the driver." That is all. Is it a story? In the next morning's paper I saw a little news item, and the last sentence of it may help you as it helped me, to weld the incidents together. It recounted the reception into Bellevue Hospital of a young woman who had been removed from number 49 East Street, suffering from debility induced by starvation. It concluded with these words. Dr. William Jackson, the ambulance physician who attended the case, says the patient will recover. A service of love, when one loves one's art, no service seems too hard. That is our premise. This story shall draw a conclusion from it, and show at the same time, that the premise is incorrect. That will be a new thing in logic, and a feat in storytelling somewhat older than the Great Wall of China. Joe Larrabee came out of the post-oak flats of the Middle West pulsing with a genius for pictorial art. At 6 he drew a picture of the town pump with a prominent citizen passing it hastily. This effort was framed and hung in the drugstore window by the side of the ear of corn with an uneven number of rows. At 20 he left for New York with a flowing necktie and a capital tied up somewhat closer. Delia Carruthers did things in 6 octaves so promisingly in a pine tree village in the south, that her relatives chipped in enough in her chip hat for her to go orth and dinish. They could not see her F, but that is our story. Joe and Delia met in an atelier, where a number of art and music students had gathered to discuss chiaroscuro, Wagner, music, Rembrandt's works, pictures, Waldteufel, wallpaper, Chopin and Dulong. Joe and Delia became enamored one of the other, or each of the other, as you please, and in a short time were married for, see above, when one loves one's art no service seems too hard. Mr. and Mrs. Larrabee began housekeeping in a flat. It was a lonesome flat something like the A-sharp way down at the left-hand end of the keyboard. And they were happy, for they had their art, and they had each other. And my advice to the rich young man would be sell all thou hast, and give it to the poor janitor for the privilege of living in a flat with your art and your Delia. Flat dwellers shall endorse my dictum, that theirs is the only true happiness. If a home is happy it cannot fit too close, let the dresser collapse and become a billiard table. Let the mantle turn to a rowing machine, the escritor to a spare bedchamber, the washstand to an upright piano. Let the four walls come together, if they will, so you and your Delia are between. But if home be the other kind, let it be wide, and long enter you at the golden gate, hang your hat on Hatteras, your cape on Cape Horn, and go out by the Labrador. Joe was painting in the class of the great magister, you know his fame. His fees are high, his lessons are light as high lights of Broadham renown. Delia was studying under Rosenstock, you know his repute as a disturber of the piano keys. They were mighty happy, as long as their money lasted. So is every, but I will not be cynical. Their aims were very clear and defined. Joe was to become capable very soon of turning out pictures, that old gentleman with thin side whiskers, and thick pocketbooks would sandbag one another in his studio for the privilege of buying. Delia was to become familiar, and then contemptuous with music, so that when she saw the orchestra seats and boxes unsold she could have sore throat and lobster in a private dining room and refuse to go on the stage. But the best, in my opinion, was the home life in the little flat, the ardent, voluble chats after the day's study, the cozy dinners and fresh, light breakfasts. The interchange of ambitions interwoven each with the others, or else inconsiderable the mutual help and inspiration. And overlook my artlessness, stuffed olives and cheese sandwiches at 11 p.m., but after a while art flagged. It sometimes does, even if some switchman doesn't flag it. Everything going out, and nothing coming in, as the vulgarians say. Money was lacking to pay Mr. Magister and Herr Rosenstock their prices. When one loves one's art, no service seems too hard. So, Delia said she must give music lessons, to keep the chafing dish bubbling. For 2 or 3 days she went out canvassing for pupils. One evening she came home elated. "Joe, dear," she said, gleefully, "I've a pupil. And, oh, the loveliest people. General A. B. Pinney's daughter on 71st Street. Such a splendid house. Joe, you ought to see the front door. Byzantine, I think you would call it. And inside. Oh, Joe, I never saw anything like it before. My pupil is his daughter Clementina. I dearly love her already. She's a delicate thing, dresses always in white, and the sweetest, simplest manners. Only 18 years old. I'm to give 3 lessons a week, and, just think, Joe, $5 a lesson. I don't mind it a bit, for when I get 2 or 3 more pupils I can resume my lessons with Herr Rosenstock. Now, smooth out that wrinkle between your brows, dear, and let's have a nice supper." "That's all right for you, deal," said Joe, attacking a can of peas with a carving knife and a hatchet, "but how about me? Do you think I'm going to let you hustle for wages, while I philander in the regions of high art? Not by the bones of Benvenuto Cellini. I guess I can sell papers or lay cobblestones, and bring in $1 or 2. Delia came and hung about his neck. "Joe, dear, you are silly. You must keep on at your studies. It is not as if I had quit my music, and gone to work at something else. While I teach I learn. I am always with my music. And we can live as happily as millionaires on $15 a week. You mustn't think of leaving Mr. Magister." "All right," said Joe, reaching for the blue scalloped vegetable dish. "But I hate for you to be giving lessons. It isn't art. But you're a trump and a dear to do it. When one loves one's art, no service seems too hard," said Delia. "Magister praised the sky in that sketch I made in the park," said Joe. "Andy Tinkle gave me permission to hang 2 of them in his window. I may sell 1, if the right kind of a moneyed idiot sees them." "I'm sure you will," said Delia, sweetly. "Andy, now let's be thankful for Jen Pinney and this veal roast." During all of the next week the Larrabees had an early breakfast. Joe was enthusiastic about some morning effect sketches he was doing in Central Park, and Delia packed him off breakfasted, coddled, praised, and kissed at 7 o'clock. Artis an engaging mistress. It was most times 7 o'clock when he returned in the evening. At the end of the week, Delia, sweetly proud but languid, triumphantly tossed 3 $5 bills on the 8x10 inches center table of the 8x10 feet flat parlor. Sometimes, she said, a little wearily, Clementina tries me. I'm afraid she doesn't practice enough, and I have to tell her the same thing so often. And then she always dresses entirely in white, and that does get monotonous. But Jen, Pinay is the dearest old man. I wish you could know him, Joe. He comes in sometimes, when I am with Clementina at the piano. He is a widower, you know, and stands there pulling his white goatee. And how are the semi-quavers and the demi-semi-quavers progressing? ', he always asks. I wish you could see the wainscoting in that drawing room, Joe. And those astrakhan rug portieres. And Clementina has such a funny little cough. I hope she is stronger than she looks. Oh, I really am getting attached to her, she is so gentle and high-bred. General Pinay's brother was once minister to Bolivia. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.